Session number 22919, Century of Killing, Jonathan Mazar.
Okay, so this is an interview with Jonathan Mazar of Survival International for the IWM film Century of Killing on January the 22nd, 2002. Since Survival International came into being, it's grown into a worldwide organisation helping to protect the lives of tribal peoples. Could you describe to us, in very broad brushstrokes, the plight of these peoples in the 20th century, which has made the work of this organisation and others like it so essential?
Well, Survival was founded in 1969 in response to reports of genocide against Indians in Brazil. And there was an article in the Sunday Times magazine exposing their treatment and atrocities being committed against them. And it was in response to that that Survival was formed. And since then, it's expanded and now works on cases of human rights abuses against tribal peoples in about 80 countries. The situation of tribal peoples in the 21st century is in some ways similar and in some ways different to how it was in 1969 when we started. What is the same is the fact that outsiders want what they have, whether it's the resources on their land or the land itself. And it is the fact that outsiders want what tribal peoples have and generally don't want the people to get in the way that is at the root of the problem, allied to a very deep-rooted, pervasive racism which is universal and sees tribal peoples as primitive and backward and in need of development. And it is those two in combination which are the direct cause of the problems that tribal peoples face and which have led to countless atrocities, killings, tribal peoples being forced off their lands, their cultures being destroyed, and indeed genocide.
When we look at other examples of genocides and mass killings, there's nearly always a process of separating out the group that's going to be targeted. But in the case of tribal peoples, there's no need to do this, as they're already physically and culturally isolated from modern society, and they often have no recognised rights within the majority culture. Could you talk a bit about how, on one hand, this makes them so terribly vulnerable, but also how they've tried to survive and to hang on to their cultural identity in the face of seemingly overwhelming odds?
Yes, I would say obviously one of the main problems that tribal peoples face in their struggle to survive is the fact that very often not only do they not speak the national language, but they may have no idea that they are even part of a nation state, and they are therefore in a uniquely disadvantaged position as regards being able to defend themselves. And that is why organizations like Survival are so necessary, because we are trying to redress the balance of power, if you like. At the moment, all the power is in the hands of their oppressors, whether those are logging companies or industrial development companies of one sort or another, or governments. And the kinds of people that Survival works with tends to be those who are most isolated, often very small in number, at the margins of colonization. In places like the Brazilian Amazon, you often have situations very similar to the Wild West 100 years ago in the States, where there is a frontier of colonization with poor peasants being forced to go onto Indians' land because the There's nowhere else for them to go, and coming into conflict with tribal peoples who not only don't want them there, but are very much at risk from their presence, from the point of view of violence and also disease, because tribal peoples generally, particularly isolated ones, don't have resistance to common Western diseases, and that is the principal cause of death these days amongst isolated tribal peoples. And that is a story that has been played out countless times over the last 500 years and is still happening today. It's a scandal, really, that that this still goes on when the ways to prevent it are known and the historical precedents are known, and the resources exist to stop it, but what isn't there is the political will. And Survival is working on many cases around the world where isolated tribal peoples are at risk or even are currently dying from Western diseases which are being introduced by colonists who are either coming onto their land because they have nowhere else to go, or because roads are being cut into through the forest into a particular area, or government is actively seeking to bring tribal people out of their lands into civilization as they would see it. So these kinds of examples are being played out all over the globe, from Brazil to India.
Well, why is it so important that these tribal peoples are able to retain their cultural identity in a world which is changing so rapidly and where it seems increasingly necessary to be able to adapt to new conditions for survival?
I suppose whether you think that tribal peoples have a right to survive and whether it's important that they survive as distinct cultures depends on whether you think people have a right to be different or not. And I think most people instinctively feel it would be a shame if everybody was the same. And one feels a kind of pang of regret when one sees evidence of things moving in that direction, of a kind of universal, rather bland Western culture being stamped on everyone. And what survival stands for is the right of people to be different, not like us, with very different ways of looking at the world, very different ways of understanding the kind of problems that face everybody. And even though they may be small in number and politically very weak, that nevertheless they have a right to survive and a right to exist as distinct cultures. And so whether you want people like tribes of the Amazon or the Bushmen of the Kalahari or Australian Aborigines to survive in the 21st century basically depends on whether you think people have a right to be different.
You've already talked a little bit about this, but sort of following on from what you've just said, I'd like you to expand on it a bit more, that there's a notion behind much of the persecution of tribal peoples that they are inferior to the supposed modern civilized persecutors, and that consequently their human rights and lives are just not as valuable as those of others. And there is, of course, a strong element of racism in this too. Can you just expand a little bit on that idea?
Well, survival stands for the principle that people have a right to be different, but just because they're different doesn't mean they're inferior, and that tribal peoples are not more backward nor more primitive nor less modern than we in the West. They're simply different. And the notion that tribal people are backward and primitive is extraordinarily deep-rooted and has its origins, I think, in 19th century notions of Darwinism and social Darwinism and evolution, And so it is astonishing how universal this notion is that we all used to be like tribal peoples are today. We have developed and moved on. It's about time they did too. And you come across this not just in places like South America, which are in one sense, you know, the elites of South America are very Western, and it may not be so surprising there, but in places like Africa, which have suffered themselves from colonization and racism, but you see exactly the same attitudes there, that how can we let people live without clothes, without proper schools, running around hunting? That's just not a proper way to live in the 21st century, is the attitude. And I think it's the most important thing that survival exists to challenge, really, is that attitude. And it's the hardest thing to challenge, and it's why our work is, you know, an extremely long-term campaign, if you like. This is something that will gradually change over decades, so that we hope in time the attitude that tribal peoples are backward will come to be seen as unacceptable as slavery is today.
How do you think that the knowledge of the world at large has sort of changed and increased over the last few years in terms of what's happening to tribal peoples? Do you think that there is a greater sympathy and a greater awareness by the international community and by the public at large? And so are they kind of getting more support, perhaps, than they used to have? Especially with the growth of human rights as well, the sort of incremental growth of human rights, that's probably made a difference. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I would certainly say that at Survival we're optimists, and that over the last 30 years there has been a noticeable improvement in the situation, if not on the ground, certainly on the level of talk and what spoken attitudes are like. For example, in the 50s and 60s, there was a case of genocide in Paraguay where the army were hunting down Aché Indians with a view to killing them and enslaving them. And that kind of thing today would be seen as completely unacceptable. And all governments in, for example, South America now at least pay lip service to the idea that tribal peoples have certain rights, particularly rights to land, and even if they're not respecting those rights on the ground, they're acknowledging them in principle. In other parts of the world, like Africa and Asia, I think there is further to go in that regard, but nevertheless, I definitely think that the global attitudes towards tribal peoples are changing for the better, and where it was once thought inevitable that all tribal peoples would eventually be assimilated into Western society, I think that is no longer universally the case, and there is a much greater recognition of their right to survive as distinct peoples, and a much greater intolerance of abuses being committed against them. But it's a very slow and gradual process.
So looking in more detail at the specific problems that tribal peoples face, most of the threats arise from the desire to gain land and resources. But this does appear, in some cases, to be linked to a vision of modernization and economic progress in the building up of a state, which is also presented as civilizing. I wondered if you, this is a harder point to talk about, but I wondered if you could say something on this and whether you think there is any link between this sort of nationalism carving out of states and the threat to many indigenous peoples.
I think it's certainly the case that tribal peoples are often seen as a rather embarrassing reminder of a country's past and a reminder that not all the members of a particular country are developed. And that is linked to a vision of development as consisting of roads, schools, health posts, people wearing clothes, driving cars, and basically living in a Western kind of way. And how to put it? In many parts of the world, there is great governmental pressure to build roads in areas where there aren't any, and the roads usually allow a lot of other people in. And this isn't just a problem of the so-called third world, it happens in countries like Canada too. Tribal peoples today tend to survive in those parts of the world where Western-style development has not yet reached. So they're kind of at the margins of industrial society, and it's now reaching them. And what we stand for is a recognition of their right to stand apart from that if they want to. Many of them don't want to. They may want many of the advantages that Western society can bring, for example, better healthcare, Western-style schooling, whatever it is, but they nearly all also very much want to hold on to their culture. And reconciling the two is a very difficult job. I don't think governments have it easy in that respect, but unfortunately, they tend to have a very dismissive attitude towards tribal peoples who may be in the way of, say, a road building program or a large mine or a large hydroelectric scheme. All these things which in our eyes represent progress, the tribal people are generally seen as an obstacle, and that undoubtedly has led to genocidal acts being committed against them because they're in the way of these kinds of schemes.
But do you think there is a link there with a sort of an idea of national identity, or do you think that doesn't exist?
I think
I don't mean whether for the tribal peoples, I mean for the state itself.
I think most countries have a fairly schizophrenic attitude towards tribal peoples. On the one hand, if you look at the kind of the way they present themselves to tourists, they often feature photos of attractively dressed tribal peoples in colourful costumes and present that as something to be proud of, look at our rich cultural heritage and so on. But on the other hand, there is almost universally an embarrassment at people who may not wear clothes or may not be Christian or Muslim or whatever it is, and in government's eyes be backward and a stigma. And so I think most governments have a fairly schizophrenic attitude towards these kinds of people. On the one hand, they're proud of them. On the other hand, they're embarrassed by them.
You've also said, you've also described a little bit about the kind of activities, which economic activities which go on, which displace tribal peoples. And I'd wonder if you could sort of talk about that again, and talking about how states encourage the migration of their urban and rural poor into the lands of tribal peoples to encourage them to farm or to log or to mine or whatever. And just describe to us briefly how that process works.
Well, most countries, particularly in Latin America, where there are tribal peoples, have extremely unequal patterns of land ownership. That is to say, a very few people in a country own most of the land, and there are vast numbers who own little or nothing. And rather than challenge the root cause of the problem, it's much easier to try and shovel the poor peasants out of the way into what may seem to be empty areas, which are usually where the tribal people are. And certainly in the past, there have been big development projects funded by people like the World Bank and big multinational institutions to develop, for example, parts of the Amazon by building roads, using them as ways of entry into hitherto unreachable forest, settling large numbers of poor peasants there who can then engage in extractive activities like logging or gold mining. And this has been one of the main causes of land invasion for tribal peoples, which is doubly tragic because generally the people who they are who are invading their lands are the poorest segments of sectors of society. But as I say, it's much easier for governments to try and cope with this problem in that way. I would say also that even in other parts of the world where land distribution is not so unequal, because tribal peoples tend now to survive at the limits of Western colonization, generally governments are very aggressively exploiting those last areas, whether it's for timber, for oil, for gas, for mines of one sort or another, for hydroelectric power, or just for the land. And there are countless examples from around the world where government-promoted schemes to settle and colonize what they think of as remote parts of their countries have brought people into conflict with tribal peoples and led to many tribes either being wiped out completely or suffering appalling devastation and survivors being reduced to living on the margins of urban society. You can see that from Bangladesh to Brazil.
The other thing I'd like you to talk about, which is kind of another level of the same thing, is how foreign governments and sort of big multinational companies can bring large investment into a country by being given access to, you know, by the government of that country to the rich resources on tribal lands. And as a result, those big multinationals can exert a great deal of influence on the country's government, especially if it's somewhat corrupt, to ignore the rights of the tribal peoples. So could you talk to us a little bit about how that international dynamic works?
And do you want that also in general terms without specific cases?
I think, yes, yeah, start off in general terms, and then if one good specific example comes to mind, that's fine to illustrate it.
How to start? Well, international law says that tribal peoples have the right to own their land. Unfortunately, no government in the world properly respects this right, even those that say they do. And as a result, in many parts of the world, tribal peoples' land is being parcelled out and opened up to companies that are interested in their natural resources, usually what's underneath the soil. And often these projects are extremely big and represent important sources of foreign exchange for the countries concerned, which are usually very poor. And this can give these big multinational companies enormous influence over the governments of those countries. It also, of course, imposes on them very important responsibilities, which they are today, I would say, more and more acknowledging, if not actually acting upon. But certainly compared to 30 years ago, for example, Western companies, mining companies or logging companies, are talking much more in terms of, we recognize that we have an obligation to the people where we are operating. It's our duty to fund social welfare programs for health and education and this kind of thing. What survival says is, that's all very well, but what you should really be acknowledging is the most important right of all, which is the right of tribal peoples to own their land, and therefore the right to say no if they don't want you there. And that is something that very few of them have actually done. That is a logical next step in the argument. It would obviously make it very difficult for most large-scale companies to operate in these areas, or at least they think it would, because they are worried that if they gave tribal peoples the right of veto over their activities, they wouldn't be able to work anywhere. In actual fact, I'm sure that's not the case. And where tribal peoples have that right, for example, in some parts of Australia, Aborigines do have the right over certain bits of their land to say to, for example, a mining company, no, we don't want you here, or yes, you can come, but subject to certain conditions. On the whole, the tribal people don't say, no, stay away. They say, yes, okay, as long as we can reach an agreement. And I think the large multinational companies are very slowly becoming more aware of their duties and their obligations as very powerful entities or very powerful actors in this drama. Their duties towards the tribal peoples as well as the countries where they operate. And also the fact that acknowledging tribal peoples' rights is not going to mean the end of the world as they know it, and not going to mean the fact that they won't be able to open a gold mine in X country or a nickel mine in Y country ever again. It just means life might be slightly harder, but they'll get a lot less flack from organisations like us, and they'll get a lot less opprobrium and embarrassment from the world's press generally, because I think global attitudes have changed significantly and are evolving, and it is seen today as more unacceptable than ever before for countries, or for companies to operate in a particular country where the controls may not be particularly tight. And the world's press, I think, knows that if there is a particular story of a company operating in some third world country on tribal people's lands, it's not good enough for the company to simply say, well, we are operating there with the permission of the government concerned, it's all kosher. That's not good enough in this day and age. They need to be acknowledging their responsibilities towards the people whose land they're working on and whose resources they're taking. And what survival would say is, they first need to acknowledge the most basic right of all, which is that if you're operating on the land of tribal peoples, it's their land, it's not yours. That gives them the right to say no, or at least to control what happens on that land.
So, following on the same thought, really, that economic progress is vital for developing countries, and it can bring significant benefits to large numbers of the population. In practical terms, are there ways in which the desirable aspects of increasing prosperity for the majority population can be achieved without the destruction of the indigenous tribal population? I mean, you've talked a little bit about that, but I wonder if you could just sort of tighten that up a bit in terms of how it might work.